Thank you very much. I was very impressed by my resume, right? my wife said, "No more degrees. That's it." I was going to do one in economics. She said, "N under no circumstances. It's one thing for you to suffer through it. It's another thing for me to suffer through it." So that's the end of that, and so on. So it's wonderful to be here this morning, and I have to say, it's wonderful to see all these young faces in front of me. It's like being back in university again. Okay, so here I am with my latest attempt to corrupt the youth. David, by the way, told me I should announce this. This is a piece of nonsense which he commissioned from me some time ago. He does this occasionally, and unfortunately, see, well, I've got the memory of a snail, so I always say yes, right, thinking it's never going to happen, it's never going to become due, and then eventually I have to actually do the damn thing, right, and then I hate David Quinn for about a week solidly, okay, and then I do it and I forget about it, and then he asks me again, and we do it all over again. This is another example, okay? All of this week I've been solidly hating David Quinn. And so on. But there we are. Which is, okay, as you know, if you've been on Twitter, it's kind of quite common, but there we are. Anyway, where was I? Okay, so look, there is so much here, and my problem is that there are so many angles to what I want to talk about today, and there are lots of things I can talk about, but maybe in the question time, if you wanted to bring those up, we could do it. Okay, so, I remember hearing the term woke for the first time a few years ago. I really not in the swim of things. People say, you're like woke, and I say, what are you talking about? Well, what is it? And then suddenly this word appears. It was like trigger warning, okay? Somebody said, and I go, what the hell is that? When somebody's about to shoot you or something? I don't know what that is, right? Anyway, eventually I do catch on, okay? I rely on my friends to educate me. And I was extremely puzzled by what appeared to me to be an arbitrary transition of the word from verb to adjective. And an adjective was supposed to describe what exactly? I wasn't quite sure. So what I'm going to talk about very briefly is the origin of the term and then the meaning of it. I'm going to give you a sort of working definition because I think it's useful to have that. Okay, it's not that it's canonical or that everybody would agree with it, but I think it's reasonably central and core. Okay, and if you want to deviate it from, that's fine. But it's always good because one of the smart aleck things that gets done to you, especially in discussions, say, what do you mean by woke? And you say, well, kind of everybody knows, and the person says, well, I don't, and you have to tell me, then you're a bit stuck. So I'm going to give you a working definition. So the origin of the term is not entirely uncontroversial, but the consensus leads us to think that it comes from Black American usage and was used to describe somebody who was awake, somebody who had, as it were, woken up, like Rip Van Winkle, to the real as distinct from the apparent nature of the social and political realities of the world around them, and remained awake. Specifically, somebody who was conscious of what was taken to be the social and political injustices, especially those connected to race. So in 1923, because it goes way back, actually, and so on. 1923, the Jamaican political activist Marcus Garvey wrote, "Wake up, Ethiopia, wake up, Africa," to call the black diaspora to social activism. Some years later, in 1938, the blues singer, if you're into blues, you know who I'm talking about, Huddie Ledbetter, also known as Leadbelly, used the term in his 1938 song, Scottsboro Boys, as a warning to black people to stay wary of racism. In 1962, William Melvin Kelly mentioned woke in a New York Times article entitled The Origin of Woke. How useful is that? Which was about white people appropriating black slang terms and mangling their meanings. How prescient was that? Okay, that's what I'm going to do this morning. So he's not the only one. So Kelly was not the only one to think that the term has been appropriated and mangled. More recently, Malaika Jabali, for example, opined that it is primarily white people who don't understand the original connotation of woke, who still say woke. For him, woke is a way to indicate being conscious and having awareness of the condition of blacks in the USA, a country that for him, quote, loves us within it of a post-racial, colorblind, meritocratic society. Rebecca Solnit is of one mind with Jabali. She tells us that, quote, woke's youth was among, in other words, the youth of the word, was among black people, but its likeness, illness, and decline came after it was kidnapped by old white conservatives. Oh, sorry, that's me, isn't it? Okay. They were often angry at words, especially new words, most particularly words that disturbed their rest, awakened them, you would say, and woke was such a word. So much for its history. What about what it means? Well, one of the most apt accounts of what woke means comes from Zaid Jilani, who'd worked for UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center, The Intercept, and the Center for American Progress, who tells us that, quote, the word woke loosely refers to a social media-fueled left-wing political ideology that emerged in the English-speaking world in the early 2010, and that clearly is its current incarnation. The term is derived from the state of being awake to or conscious of structural inequalities in society and being hyper-aware of one's own role in these inequalities. He goes on to say, and I want you to note this, because it's very relevant to what I'm going to say today, that someone who is woke is constantly inspecting every institution in society, looking for the presence of racism, sexism, and other forms of pervasive prejudice, constantly inspecting. Okay. Now, that isn't a hermeneutics of suspicion. I don't know what a hermeneutics of suspicion is. Well, isn't being woke just another name for being progressive, being kind of with it and liberal and left and so on? And well, no, not quite. You see, for Jelani, who says, quote, what separates someone who is woke from someone who is merely progressive is not only this vigilance and awareness, but a fervent belief that everyone must be enlisted into their social causes at all costs. This is an evangelical mission, right? And that the end justifies the means when battling injustice. And this isn't anything goes, no holds barred policy. Okay. So it's important to grasp immediately then that wokists are not liberals in either the classical or the contemporary sense of that term. You can make a big mistake when you're discussing, okay? They're not. Okay. They're not classical liberals, they're not contemporary liberals in the American kind of or UK sense. Quoting Jelani once more, he said, unlike traditional liberals, woke Americans place very little stake in value neutral norms like freedom of speech. Well, there's a shock, okay? And non-discrimination. As an anti-racist activist, Ibram Kendi, of recent fame, as you might have noticed if you've been reading, says, quote, the only remedy to racist discrimination is anti-racist discrimination. The only remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination. Kendi also informed us that you could only be racist or anti-racist. There is no middle ground. Wokists, then, are aware of what they perceive as systemic injustice, inequality, oppression, and discrimination, and they work actively to challenge and dismantle those unjust and oppressive systems by advocating social justice and by exposing and countering institutionalized power dynamics. David, would you hand that song? So I'm just going to give you a handout now because I'm going to talk about, here comes the definition, okay? It's on that sheet coming around to you, okay? But while it's going around, let me give it to you. So wokeism, quote, first of all, an illiberal, social media-fueled, relatively recent left-wing ideology, left-wing in a general, a larger sense, right? It's an ideology that characterizes itself as awake, that is acutely conscious of what it perceives as structural or systemic inequalities and injustices in society relating to race, gender, and pretty much Uncle Tom Cobley and all. A whole lot, I mean, whatever. It operates with a witchfinder general hermeneutics of suspicion. If you're non-white and you don't, as I am, sorry, if you're non-white and you don't perceive systemic racism, then you're a victim of false consciousness. If you're black, for example, and you say, I don't know what you're talking about, they go, ha ha ha, false consciousness. You see, they've got you. Okay, you're so oppressed and so that you don't even know you're oppressed. How about that? Okay, so equality is racist. Meritocracy is the tool of oppression. Treating everybody equally is oppressive. Treating people different by virtue of their group membership is equitable. Wokeism is evangelical in its efforts to convert all to its cause. It has no scruples whatsoever about the ways and means it employs. This is something you have to be aware of. Okay, normally, my presumption when I'm talking to somebody is that I'm speaking to them in good faith, that we share rationality, we share a commitment to evidence and argument and so on. You cannot make that assumption when you're talking to somebody who's woke. They don't play by those rules. Absolutely, you need to know. You can't operate in this world if you don't understand who it is that you're talking to. That's if they're talking to you at all, right? And finally, their object of this unscrupulous evangelistic activism is to rectify and dismantle those perceived systemic inequalities or injustices by exposing institutionalized power dynamics. That's a bit of a mouthful, okay? But at least if you have this, you have something that you can commit to memory, at least in part, and use when somebody asks you what is woke, okay? I should note, by the way, in passing, that the intellectual grounding of wokeism, insofar as it has one, appears to be located in its absorption, in the absorption, I beg your pardon, by cultural studies of postmodernism. In its political manifestation, postmodernism is, and you have it there, suspicious of all grand narratives, rejects all universal truths, except, of course, the universal truth of wokeism. Always. This is one of the things you notice, by the way, about universal skepticism, is that it always accepts itself from its skepticism, which is self-refuting, but leave that to one side. Who's worried about that? So I contradict myself, so what, right? It rejects any notion of uncontaminated objectivity or neutral facts. It rejects the idea of rationality. It regards history, society, social norms, culture, language, as all of them being impositions of or expressions of oppressive social structures. That's a given. That's not something you need evidence for. That's simply a given. That's a basic belief, if you're woke. And postmodern knowledge is subjective. It manages to combine a chedia, which is nothing really matters, one of the seven deadly sins, by the way. People think of it as sloth, meaning laziness. It's not. It's thinking of the world as having no meaning. Nothing matters. Nothing really matters. Okay. Actually, sorry, that's Queen, isn't it? Yeah, there we are. See how cool I am? Well, I was cool in the 70s. But anyway, managing to combine a chedia with its contrary, except what matters to me. Again, you get that contradiction. Nothing matters. Except what matters to me. And typically, by the way, criticizes the culture of the postmodernist writer or speaker, but not that of others. My culture stinks. My culture is rotten. My culture is racist. My culture is systemically oppressive. Other cultures are just fine. Now, what are some examples of the object of woke's attention? Well, as you might expect, race, Black Lives Matter, again in the news recently. Okay. Taking the knee at, I had to wait until the 5 minutes in start of each game because I couldn't bear to watch it. It was so embarrassing. It was so cringeworthy. Okay, I waited for 5 minutes. I was hoping they wouldn't score a goal in the first 5 minutes. Okay, but then I couldn't bear to watch it. Gender equality, women everywhere. Okay, the more the better, except of course in the matter of dirty jobs because men can have those, right? That's fine if you have all those. Athena Swan in the universities. Oh my God, if you're not in the teaching business or the administrative business of universities, you won't know what that is. But that's the new CREE that you have to sign up to. Okay, I mean, I might talk about that a bit later. LGBT plus, whatever that is. Gender neutral, no TERFs. Okay, this is a TERF free zone where those are horrible people. In fact, one of the strangest things that's happened to me over the last number of years is I've become a hero to some feminists, which is really truly stunning. I can't get over this. So much so that they started coming up to me and shaking my hand. I think I'm living in some kind of bizarre world. It's just so weird, especially after all the fights I've been having over the years. But on this one, as I said, when it comes to the women, the real women, that is, I'm on their side. So that's made me some friends, at least in this regard. Pronouns, resistance to linguistic oppression, checking one's privilege as white, male, heterosexual. What can I say? I'm a horrible person. I am white. I'm male. The last time it mattered, I was heterosexual. When was that again? And so on. You have to admit to the dominance of white supremacy. If you don't, I mean, again, you're just refusing. You're just being racist, okay? Because clearly, white supremacy. I grew up in 1950s Ireland. It was clearly white supremacy because my family didn't really have enough to live on. And it wasn't quite Angela's ashes. We were better off than most people. But I don't quite remember being a matter of kind of white supremacy. Supremacy over who? What? Okay. If that was white supremacy, you can keep it. Anyway, critical race theory, of course, which is everywhere. Now embedded, by the way, now the Higher Education Authority in Ireland has signed up for it. And my UCD, where I taught for 30 years, signed up to it earlier last month. I'm so ashamed. It's horrible. It makes the presumption, by the way, it assumes that systemic racism is embedded in the higher education institutions. And I'm going, what, in Ireland? Right? When I was growing up in the 1950s, the only black person you ever saw was somebody who was a medical student in UCC. What are you talking about? Okay, it's quite bizarre. Right? Censorship, cancellation of those who oppose them, free speech, obviously being a thinly disguised instrument of oppression. Don't talk at me. Climate, global warming, we're all going to die tomorrow. And an insistence upon reparations, quite from whom to whom and for what, is a bit of a mystery, but don't let that bother you. Okay, and affirmative action, that is positive discrimination, as we saw from what's his name I mentioned a while ago. And of course, the ever-present, what I call DIE, diversity, inclusion, and equity. It's all over the place, right? Everybody else calls it either DEI or EDI, but I always insist on calling it DIE, right? And so anyway, if I had to pick one theme, one central item to focus on to be an umbrella under which all these disparate policies shelter, would be what I'm going to call identitarianism. A bit of a mouthful, and I kind of tried to think of some more apt, some more, I don't know, easier to say term, but let's just go with this, right? I'm not committed to that term. If somebody comes up with a better one, I'll happily live with it. And there are two other important things I'm going to talk about. There are many, but there are two other important ones. One is the self-righteousness of people who are woke, which is unbelievable. Okay, even me in my most arrogant moments, and if you want to know about that, you can talk to my wife. Okay, who's known me for 52 years. Okay, 45 of them being married. Okay, am I due for parole? No. sorry, she is. Oi, beside you. And destructive activism. So those are the two things. I'll only say something very briefly about those two. I'm going to talk about identitarianism for the most part. So identitarianism is the front and centering of identities, collectivities, or groups as the prism through which social and political realities are to be viewed. Think of it another way, it's anti-individualism. Individuals don't count. Groups, who the group you belong to because of certain characteristics, whatever those might be, that's what it's on. So what makes woke significant is that problems with social justice generally are to be located not in the acts or decisions of individuals, but in the overall thrust of social and political systems, and moreover, that the victims of injustice are not just individuals, but whole categories or types, race, sex, and so on, all with their own identities. So what matters, as I said, is not the individual, but the group, not you, but your group identity. There are victims and victimizers. Who is in which category is not a matter of individual acts and responsibility, but of group identity and allegiance. And some victims are more victims than others. So it's no use you saying, or my saying, I don't remember actually having victimized anybody recently, okay, or oppressed anybody. And they go, it doesn't matter. You're in the wrong group. You're in the oppressor group, and therefore you are an oppressor. And I go, well, it's news to me. And they go, well, that's too bad. Okay, it shows just how unenlightened you are. Discrimination is embedded in cultural systems, patriarchy, white supremacy. By the way, if anybody wants to know more about patriarchy and so on, I've written a book called After Me Too, which is slightly polemic, and you can still get it on Amazon if you want. White supremacy, regardless of the actions of individuals within them, and denying this makes such individuals complicit in the discrimination and injustice. In essence, wokeism is an ideology that borrows the oppressed tool of analysis from Marxism and transposes it onto race, gender, and sexuality. By the way, many people see this as a kind of neo-Marxist movement. I don't. It takes that category and then uses it up. So anyway, let's consider identities of groups. This is the kind of theoretical side of this. So apologies if you're bored by this, just turn off the hearing aid for about 10 minutes. So welcome back. Okay. Are groups, corporations, tribes, clans, nations, and states just convenient ways of organizing the lives of individuals, or do these collectives have a measure of real existence of their own? If so, are they at least as real, or perhaps even more real, than the individuals who constitute them? That would seem to be the tendency of wokeism, right? Now, the dispute about the ontological status of groups or collectives is a reenactment of the classic battle between Platonists and Aristotelians. Gavin, Ashton, and I were talking about this last night, and I promised him I would mention Plato today. Here it is. Here's the Plato mention, Gavin. So, transferred from the Empyrean heights of metaphysics to the sublunary arena of human action. Are the forms, a la Plato, more real than the things of this world existing apart from them, yet giving them whatever in the real world, a small measure of reality that they have? Or are the forms of things, a la Aristotle, making something that makes things to be what they are, but having no independent real existence apart from them? The argument is not merely of historical interest. It's a perennial area of philosophical dispute, by the way. Today, as Tom Palmer notes, quote, an army of illiberal academics have posited an array of social forces of domination, including class, gender, race, and other categories, that are more active and real than the mere flesh and blood, quote-unquote, individuals that surround us, although it takes the hard work of tenured professors to see these social forces properly and without distortion, end of quote. For such latter-day Platonists, reality is a kind of bloodless ballet of intersecting and interacting abstractions, a phantasmagoria of forms, whereas the concrete chattels of our everyday world are things of little or no ultimate significance. I'm not saying this is Plato, by the way. Okay, I absolve Plato from all of this. Now, it's certainly true that we can speak of groups or associations and that these groups or associations can constitute the subject or object of sentences with action verbs. For example, the state today recognizes obligation to care for the long-term disabled, or, quote, the government issued instructions to all local authorities concerning levels of local taxation, or the university has adopted a new entrance policy for disadvantaged students. What is the ontological, moral, or legal status of the subject of these sentences? So it seems to me that there are three positions you can take on this. So sorry if this is theoretical, but given that, if you like, collectivity is at the core of Wokeism, I think it's useful to have something like this. So we can have a position we can call collective nominalism, that denies that these groups or associations have any mode of existence at all, being merely a convenient way of speaking of individuals cooperating with each other. Right? So these groups really don't exist. Okay. You could subscribe to collective realism. This is in the Platonic sense of realism, and hold that such groups have a transcendent reality above and beyond the members who constitute them, or the relationships, informal or contractual, that bind these members together. Okay, and this is kind of Hegelian type. Okay, so the group is actually more real, more substantial. And it's interesting that wokeism is, though they don't even know it, are in fact kind of crypto-Hegelians. In this regard, I think they might be surprised to know this. I'm not sure if they'd be pleased, but they would certainly be surprised. And then finally, you could have what I call collective epiphenomenalism, which is the position that social groups and associations are entities of a sort created and sustained by a network of intentions, often embodied in rules, laws, and constitutions of those who compose them, either informal, as say with football supporters or supporters of the Irish team, where I'll be cheering tonight at 8 o'clock, when the third, or collectives. Either formal or formal, as with members of a corporation where you have legal things that constitute what it is that you are. Now, of these three positions, I'm inclined to be a collective epiphenomenalist. In other words, I'm not a realist. Okay, I don't think the groups and so on have a reality over and above the members, but I don't think it's simply an accidental collection of individuals and so on. So the relations, there are real relations, constitute these groups as the kind of thing that can, in a sense, be an actor. But in the end, ultimately, it's only individuals who act. And when you act as the chairman of the board, okay, you're an individual acting in your capacity as chairman of the board as constituted by those rules, and not, as it were, simply as Joe Bloggs and so on, with a wife and four kids and so on. Human action, then, whatever else it may be, is ineluctably particular. Think about it. You can't take a dog for general, for a walk in general, or post a letter in general, to no one in particular. It has to be this particular dog, now in this particular park, this particular letter to this particular person, posted in this particular box at this particular time. All action is ineluctably particular. Collectives then have a secondary mode of existence consisting ontologically of a network of relationships subsisting among individual human beings. These relationships, by the way, are real, but not imaginary. But so on. And so to the same extent are the collectives constituted by them. So a family, for example, is a set of human beings related by genetics, usually, social categories, upbringing, and a shared social environment. A football team is a set of human beings related by a particular purpose, determined by the constitutive rules of the game, the organizational rules of football's governing association, and so on and so forth. We can say that the family did that, or the football team did this, but in the end, only individual human beings act. Some actually individual scores the goal. Some individual actually puts the ball down over the line, which they're going to do repeatedly tonight, I should tell you, by the way, at least four times. Okay, it's my prediction. Anyway, when we make a collective the subject of a sentence, what we're describing is the action of an individual or individuals under a certain description. So this is Auberon Herbert, the 19th century English writer, said, if a crowd, a town, a nation is not, in each case, a collection of individuals more or less acted on, it is true, by certain common feelings, more or less possessing certain common interests, what can it be? By the way, Auberon Herbert, one of those neglected writers whom, if you haven't read, you should read. Now, I want to talk now about diversity a little bit, because that's one of the unholy trinity of diversity, inclusion, and equality, equity, rather. In its dictionary meaning, diversity simply means the condition or quality of being different. Nothing complex about that. For a wokist, however, diversity is the term that applies to people who differ from one another by virtue of their membership of particular groups, groups characterized by race, religion, sex, and sexual preference, which groups have ostensibly been denied privileges that have been enjoyed by others. So diversophiles, the people who love diversity, hold this an article of faith that those who are members of a victimized group are entitled to special compensatory privileges. In the case of previously discriminated against groups, their current successors are entitled to compensation because of the previous prejudicial treatment of their ancestors and the supposed continuing disadvantage of the members of such groups' experience. By the way, anyone who's really interested in this should read Thomas Sowell on affirmative action, brilliant book. Okay, it's affirmative action around the world. Okay, so instead of just focus on the USA or the UK and so on, he talks about India and Malaysia and South Africa and so on, and all of these places. It's absolutely brilliant, and he's just devastating, as he usually is. So diversity is about treating groups as having, as it were, saved up a right to special privileges in proportion to how much their purported ancestors were victimized in the past. There are all sorts of problems with this. First of all, finding out who is a member of what group and how far you want to go back. Okay, you'd like to go back 35,000 years, that's fine with me. Okay, because you can trace which group I belong to and so on. But anyway, it may not be immediately obvious that what is so special or wonderful about diversity that invested with such transcendent moral significance. After all, everyone is diverse from everybody else in some way or another, otherwise we would be different. But some people, it seems, are more diverse than others. In the special sense that the term diversity is acquired, pretty much everyone is diverse in some significant respect or other, unless that person happens to be white, male, Christian, conservative, or heterosexual. Damn. I lose out on all of these, right? Okay, any diversity for me? No. So diversity then is to be understood to apply to race, if it exists, sex, if there is any such thing, gender, if it's different from sex, or perhaps especially if it isn't, age, religion, sexual preference, ethnicity, language, political beliefs, the right, sorry, left kind. This list is not closed, and other categories may be added as the spirit of the age moves. Diversity, however, most emphatically does not apply to certain modes of thinking, especially those conservative modes of thought that would call the sacred diversity dogma into question. So you can have diversity all over the place in universities, but not diversity of thought. Okay, if you look at the composition of staff, you'll see that they're almost uniformly, depending on where you go, somewhere between 75 to 95% of one particular persuasion. For many of the left today, and that includes wokists, anyone who speaks in favor of group blindness is on the wrong side of history. And this is a real shock to me because it took me a long time to kind of come to grasp that we shouldn't, you know, because it's part of like social moral maturation, that you really shouldn't be making judgments about people simply because of their possession of certain characteristics. Human beings are individuals. Okay, and therefore, if you're relating them, especially one-to-one, you want to deal with that individual as they are in their concrete reality, not because of their skin color or their sex or their sexual preference or whatever this might be. And I'm being told that's all wrong. If I'm going to say, I don't care what color skin you have, that makes me a racist. Hang on a second, I'm a bit puzzled. I thought that didn't make me a racist. But now a sudden peculiar inversion that actually makes me a racist. And I'm really confused on this one. For some, especially those in college campuses, anyone who doesn't swallow the anti-oppression orthodoxy, hook, line, and sinker, anyone who doesn't acknowledge white supremacy in America, is a racist. To suggest that one should be in different group identity today is to invite accusations of collusion in oppression. And even that icon of the left, the 2016 would-be US presidential candidate, Bernie Sanders, got into trouble when he suggested back then that it wasn't enough for someone to say, hey, I'm Latina, vote for me. And he got into trouble for saying that. I would have thought, well, yeah, there's no reason to vote for somebody or not vote for somebody. Anyway, I'm just going to say, so that's the end of that nonsense and identitarianism. So you can all turn your hearing aids back on and continue. Let me just very briefly say something about the two other aspects that I think are important, but I don't have time to discuss in detail, but we could talk about them later if you want. One is the self-righteousness. In fact, priggishness. It's astonishing and it's infuriating. The assumption is we are enlightened. We, for the first time in the human race, have discovered what the real thing is in going on in society. You are benighted. You are stupid. That's if you're not actually evil. And this is one of the interesting things here. By the way, I'm used to living in a world where I disagree with people. When I disagree with people, obviously we differ from one another. If I believe that A is true and somebody else says A is false, we are disagreeing. But I assume that they're committed to rationality, and we can have arguments. We may not at the end of the day convince one another, but that's it, and so on. So when I believe A and somebody else believes not A, I think I'm right and I think they're wrong, which is usually the case. Okay, but I don't think they necessarily think they're evil. You can be wrong without being evil. The trouble is that this is an asymmetrical relationship. I think wokists are wrong. They think I'm evil, not just wrong, but evil, and that determines how they treat you. And remember, no holds barred, anything goes. Right? So you have to be very careful. So the second thing then of note about wokeism that I would add to identitarianism is the psychological attitude of wokeists, already noted by Jelani, and that is their extreme self-righteousness. There are viewpoints, terms that are simply unacceptable and must preemptively be censored or, if expressed, attacked, going to be cancelled. One is not only right and one's opponent's wrong, one opponents are wicked and evil. Wokeism is characterized by self-righteousness in an extreme degree. Here is a case where the worst are full of a passionate intensity. That's all I have to say about that. The other one I want to talk about, and it's obviously going to be very important, but I'll just mention it in passing. To these two factors, identitarianism and self-righteousness, we may add social activism directed towards the dissolution of existing cultural norms and their replacement. This is actually the most dangerous side of all this. Okay, let me start, because this deserves more than I've written. History is replete with societies that have decided that what's gone up to now is really, really bad. And what we need to do is wipe all that out and start again from scratch. The trouble with doing that is that wiping everything out involves wiping a lot of people out. And starting from scratch generally means chaos, disorder, and the reemergence of all the nastiness of which human beings are capable. Think of Kampuchea, killing fields of Cambodia. Think of the Great Leap Forward in China, and so on. It's happened in different places. It's a really, really bad idea. The world, whatever the way it is, and however bad it might be, and whatever things need to be mended, it's the world we have. Okay? If you wipe it out, you are likely, pulling up all the plants in your garden. Okay, and so on. All what you get is weeds. Weeds grow everywhere. Okay, and that's what happens in these things. So it's a really bad idea. So wokeism might seem to be a trivial and temporary annoyance, another explosion of the bumptiousness that one can get from the young who are convinced, as they have always been, that their elders are simply benighted. That's what I used to think. Okay, and I was right in my case. But in fact, wokeism is a tool, albeit an unwitting tool for the most part, for cultural revolution. They're not a major part of this, okay, but they are. They almost act like the kind of green guards, okay, if you can call it that, as the red guards that in China, for other people who have their own particular agenda, and these dovetail very nicely. Okay, in this enterprise, then, the wokerati play the role of useful idiots. It's part of, in fact, of a strategy to destroy our Western Christian culture, replace it with the World Economic Forum and the Schwabian New Culture Reset. Parallels here with the Cultural Revolution in China and others, it's just so obvious. But anyway, none of this is a conspiracy, by the way. This is all out in the open. This is a conspiracy lying hidden in plain sight, right on the table in front of you. You've been told about it, okay? I'm not making this up. This is not me in my kind of bizarre conspiracy mode. This is right there. Existing institutions must be destroyed and a blank slate created. Nothing is anything and everything can be something else. I call that the doctrine of radical plasticity. Nothing is real. Nothing has a character. Nothing is anything in particular. We can make anything to be anything we want by an act of the will, almost as it were in a quasi-divine way. Anyway, just leave all that to one side. So where do young people stand on this? Well, in the schools, of course, the indoctrination is going full swing. And we see it here happening in Ireland, various programs being brought in. It's the same in the UK. It's the same in the USA. I'm now quoting from a piece by Kaufman, by the way. The references are, there's a whole pile of references to various YouTube videos and so on in there. I've stolen some of this material unashamedly. So don't come back and accuse me of plagiarism. I'm admitting to it. Okay, and so on. Anything I found useful, I steal. I'm a kind of an intellectual jackdaw. Anyway, according to Kaufman, the piece in here by Kaufman, young people are evenly divided by and large on the culture war issues, which is actually interesting. The rest of the population are largely impatient and don't want anything to do with it. But the 50-50 split means when it comes to young people, there's a lot to play for. Things can be done. And that's why we're addressing you today. Things are actually likely to get worse before they get better. So critical race theory is endorsed by 23% of councils in the UK, who, by the way, also refuse access to teaching materials. They do this and so on. They do this in relation to sex education as well. Just try to find out what exactly are you doing. I'm sorry, this is copyright. We can't give this out. That's interesting. Yeah, you can't even let me see what's in this. Those young people who've been indoctrinated in schools favor CRT and oppose free speech, roughly 60-40. I'm surprised it's not more. For those who haven't, it's 40-60. Students are being presented with theories of systemic racism, multiple genders, and patriarchy as indubitable facts. These are not things to be discussed. These are not possibilities. These are simply facts and so on, almost like a latter-day catechism. Universities, by the way, are not in much better place. 47% think being careful, listen to this, 47% of students in the UK think being careful not to offend others is more important than speaking freely. More important. I'm not saying going around offending people deliberately is a good idea. I've done it in my time. I'll probably do it again. But students are under pressure to conform to the political views and activism of their lecturers. Okay. More on this in a moment. We recently saw the cancellation, for example, of Helen Joyce at Cambridge, and even our own proto-feminist Mary Kenny was disinvited from the University of Limerick, basically. Seriously? Okay, give me a break. Extreme instances of in-groupism, which involve demonizing the other, heretics are shunned and ostracized and vilified. It's authoritarian, it's anti-intellectual, and it's appalling. The woke warriors think of themselves, by the way, as being rebels, when in fact they are the latter-day establishment. With teaching staff on your side, media on your side, legal profession on your side, government on your side, government ministers on your side, government policies on your side. And we're the rebels. Okay, great. Good luck with that. So what's happening in the universities? I'm going to more or less finish up with this. Universities today are largely run by bureaucrats, which is not good for the university. Not good for students, certainly not good for the university staff. Usually former academics who, for one reason or another, I hesitate to say incompetence or inability, but if I was being uncharitable, that's perhaps what I would say, who appear to value a quiet life above all else and are unwilling to face down the unrepresentative identitarians who infest the students' unions and who regard free speech as a front for the oppression of the marginalized and not a means by which ideas can be expressed, evaluated, and explored, which is what you might think, if you didn't know it, the university would actually be about. Campus racism is everywhere, it seems, from casual conversation in the university's bars to the university curriculum itself. The curriculum is too white, understimulating black students who are unable to identify with what they're being taught. Now, this is kind of interesting because I didn't identify with a lot of what I was taught when I was young. I mean, it was experience. Again, leave university aside for a moment. Let's just talk about film. Okay, when one of the escapes from rain-sodden 1950s Cork, that I grew up in, where color hadn't been invented, okay, everything was gray, was getting enough money from my dad, after much persuasion, to go to the cinema on a Saturday afternoon and watch some swashbuckling guy on the, you know, in the Caribbean and so on, and then come back out at 5:30 into the sodden rain covered and so on. And were any of these films about Irish people? No, none, not a single one, okay? They're all about, and did I want them to be? God, no, that's the last thing I wanted them to be. I had that in spades, okay, in reality. I didn't want this. I wanted to live in this fantasy world for at least 2 or 3 hours to escape, as most people do in their entertainment. Anyway, so this is the universities where we should be talking about these things and examining, and people should be free to express, if they wish, these views and so on. But there's things for discussion and others dogmas that cannot be controverted. So once upon a time, and not so very long ago, to be a victim was to be somebody who was weak and deserved pity. Now to be a victim is to establish a preemptive claim on a moral and often a legal status that is empowering. This is especially characteristic of today's identity politics, where various groups compete in an unseemly competition to establish who among the legion of victims is the most victimized. This is where intersectionality comes in. Okay, if you can manage to actually claim a place in more than one victimized category, you can outdo the others. Okay, so if you're a woman, you're a victim, right? But if you're a black woman, that's two. Okay, if you're a black woman lesbian, that's three. Okay, you can imagine. Okay, and you come to the top of the hierarchy, you win. Okay, it's all yours. Anyway, so Peter Woods, author of the classic book, by the way, called Diversity, published a piece on what he calls the seven types of suppression of free speech. I'll just take that as an instance. That take place in US campuses. And I should add, not just US campuses. These seven little intellectual dwarves can be handily remembered by the mnemonic created by their initials, outrage, O-U-T-R-A-G-E. First of all, this is how it works. O, ostracize dissenters from woke orthodoxy. That's what you do. Call it cancellation, call it and so on. Disinvite any controversial, that is, conservative or libertarian speakers. Better still, don't invite them in the first place. If, despite your best efforts, one succeeds in coming, disrupt the event, pull the fire alarm, or threaten such disorder that the university will cancel the event for health and safety reasons. That's what you do. You usurp the curriculum. Work to eliminate all courses that run counter to the new normative environment. In particular, make sure nothing that could possibly be seen as a validation of Western civilization makes it onto the curriculum. If such courses are already there, get rid of them as quickly as possible. T, train students to be activists. That's what a lot of our university staff do. It's entirely disreputable and so on, but that's what they do. If you're a lecturer, turn your courses into advocacy programs. Train your students to mistake feelings of outrage and indignation for learning and to think that the goal of a university education is transformation, not the transformation, of course, of yourself, but of those benighted others and the system as a whole in the interest of social justice. Train your students to be on the lookout for anything. Remember the hermeneutics of suspicion? A word, a speech, a course, a university policy, an incident of bias, real or imagined, a hate crime, real or imagined, that can be the occasion for a staged emergency or a planned panic. I can remember, actually, I was in an MA course. I mentioned those of you who know the Sherlock Holmes stories know that he often made use of the little kids who used to run around, who did sort of homeless and so on. And so I mentioned this, and I used the term that's used in the thing, which is street Arabs. That's what they were called at the time. And there was an audible intake of breath from my students as if I had insulted. I mean, sorry, an entire race. And I just said, sorry, I'm like, that's just what they were doing. Okay, fine, you don't want to use the term, don't you? And I thought, wow, my God, that was towards the end of my career. It probably would have been the end of my career if I'd continued. But anyway, or repress topics deemed unfit for discussion. Prevent wrong ideas from being heard. That's good. But even better is to prevent them from ever being thought. Anyone expressing doubt as to the correctness of favored doctrines, for example, the existence of campus rape culture, is to be castigated for defending rapists and victim blaming. These and many other articles of faith are off limits to reasonable inquiry, forget statistics, forget data. None of that's relevant. Okay, these are dogmas. Dogmas, you don't need data. And exempt from the requirement to possess evidential support. A, aggress against the old order and those who uphold it. Those who refuse to get with the social justice program actively must not be allowed to rest in peace. In other words, you can't say, well, look, okay, I just want a quiet life. Just go do your craziness over here. No. There's no escape from you. Remember, you're a target. Okay, you can't just say, I'd like to be on my own. I'd like to shut my door in my room and do my stuff. It won't work. They must be subjected to diversity training or sexual harassment training or other forms of psychological manipulation. It's incredible. Any form of resistance to this institutionalized aggression is to be regarded as microaggression and dealt with severely. Right? G, group identity by race, sex, and ethnicity. And we're back to where I was talking about. So identity at all. Everything is a matter of which groups or groups you or your enemies belong to. Argument and evidence matter not a whit. If you're a man, you're wrong. If you're a woman, you're right. I believe her, believe women. What? Even if they contradict one another? I'm a bit puzzled. How does that work? Right? Believe all women every time? What? Women are superhuman? Women have never been known to tell a lie? Okay? I'm sorry. I love women. Okay? But are they on the real world here? Sorry? I don't understand how this works. The only question is, in this instance, are you telling a lie or are you telling the truth? Not whether, generically speaking, you're incapable of doing it, right? Anyway, if you're non-white, you're underprivileged, unless, of course, you're Asian, and that doesn't count. Okay. Science and logic and argument are all tools of male oppression, clearly. The principles of criminal law, in particular, the principle that those accused of crimes are to be presumed innocent until proven guilty, are merely devices to prevent rapists from being convicted by accusation alone. Recent case, some, I think it was Manchester United, had one of their footballers accused of sexual misdemeanors or rape and so on. And they put him on the in the panel and so on. And there were protests from people who said, what message does this send? And I would have said, the message it sends is that people are actually presumed innocent until they're convicted. Right. But that wasn't what the question was meant to do. It was meant to say, oh, the accusation is enough. Somebody must be, so the process is the punishment. It doesn't matter, okay, whether you're convicted or not. We had a case about 5 or 6 years ago where 4 rugby players in Belfast were accused of rape and so on. Again, the thing went on for months. Their pictures were in the paper. They were on TV. Their names, everybody knew their names and so on. Not the name, by the way, of the supposed victim and so on. And in the end, they were all acquitted. And their careers were ruined. Apart from the fact that it cost them a fortune to defend themselves, right? But that doesn't matter. Okay, anyway, and finally, E, exalt the new eternal truths and exempt them from questioning and critical examination. Western civilization is inherently racist and sexist and oppressive, and students mustn't be distracted from affirming this article of faith by anything that it might show that the castigated civilization is actually the source of criticism of racism, sexism, and oppression. Keep students away from the classics. Ancient and modern, all of them products of old white men. On no account are students to read Mills on Liberty or Locke's Treatise on Government or Sophocles' Antigone or anything that might disturb their faith. History is especially forbidden unless it serves as a source of examples of just how racist and sexist and oppressive our ancestors were, for which racism, sexism, and oppression we now must all atone. If students are to read anything at all, and remember, reading is not all it's cracked up to be, then let them read from the approved set of orthodox writers who will uncritically reinforce their insulated set of painfully acquired prejudices. You know, sometimes I think I've been beamed up to a parallel universe. Okay, it's really strange. At one time, those who were censored used to be those deemed to be most incorrectly fascist. Now it's anyone whose views are not in line with the current gender, protean sexuality, multicultural, whatever you're having yourself, phobic orthodoxy. Even foundational feminists such as Germaine Greer have come under judgment of being found wanting. Our students have been reared in the cotton wool culture of comfort, becoming what Brendan O'Neill calls Stepford students. Mental and emotional pain of any kind is not, as it is for most people, simply the cost of living in a relatively free world, but some kind of radical moral flaw in the universe that must be eliminated at all costs. When I was a student, university authorities censored speech on campus against the students' wishes. I know it's hard to believe, but that's what they did. Whereas now university authorities enforce the banning in accordance with the wishes of the infantilized post 9/11 students who believe they have a right not to be disturbed, upset, or annoyed. They're like children who haven't been allowed to play in the psychic dirt and so haven't developed psychic immunities. So what to do? Now you may look at your sheet in front of you, right? So first of all, let me tell you what's on this. Apart from the definition of woke and a little bit about, did I put stuff in there on postmodernism? I don't think so. It doesn't matter. Anyway. I wish I could give you a kind of cast iron strategy, which I know from experience to work. I can't. There isn't any. So let me begin. Do not lie or prevaricate. Okay? Even by suggestion, even by silence. Do not do any of these things. You're not always called upon to start a fight. Sometimes, you know, you just say, yeah, nice to meet you, and move away. You don't always have to be a martyr. But you may not lie. You may not prevaricate. You should speak the truth in love. Love, by the way, being a disinterested desire for the welfare of others, not a soft-hearted and especially soft-headed sentimental desire to avoid offense at all costs. You shouldn't go out of your way to offend people, okay, despite my dismal record in this thing and so on. But if people are going to take offense at when you say the truth as well as nicely as you can, there's nothing you can do about it. That's the way the world works. Never cooperate formally with evil of any kind. You cannot do that. Material cooperation in the world in which we live is sometimes necessary. In other words, in the world in which we live, you may have to make use of things and services and go to hospitals where, for example, abortions or whatever are done. That's almost impossible. You cannot live in this world. As they say in West Side Story, you want to live in this lousy world? Okay, well, yeah, you have to live in this world, but that's material cooperation. We may not formally cooperate. But it should be limited, and the circumstances that make it necessary should be avoided. For example, I mean, if you're in a job where the level of material cooperation and things that are evil is high, you should get another job. Okay, admittedly, I'm not asking you to starve yourself, just give up your job and so on, but you should transition from the job you're in somewhere else as quickly as possible. Remember, above all, by the way, that wokeism is in a way a form of a secular religion, and therefore has the kind of characteristics that religion has. People are committed to it. People are going to be upset if you question it, what they regard as their sacred dogmas. If you think of it now, I'm not saying it is a religion in all respects, but if you think of it as a kind of secular religion, it will help you to understand what happens when you're talking to people, why they get so upset. And its exponents are true believers, in the Eric Hoffer, who wrote a wonderful book on true believers, sense of the term. Now, what you can do is let your interlocutor know that you too are aware and concerned of instances of injustice. Get them to speak. Much better actually to let them speak and listen, and they'll be surprised if you're not jumping all over them and so on. And just say, my favorite phrase, especially when I get a bit of cheek and insubordination on Twitter, is tell me more. Okay? Now, very often that silences the person on the other side completely. Okay? Sometimes they tell me more and they simply dig themselves into a pit, and I go, that's really interesting. Tell me more. Okay? And eventually they give up. It's great. Get them to speak. Ask them, by the way, above all, what would be the final position with which they would be content? What would make you happy? In other words, what would be the situation that you'd arrive at where you said everything's just fine now? We can all stop, get on with it. And they will be astonished because, of course, they'll never have thought of that. And in fact, there isn't anything because, in a way, they're committed, like other people before them, to a species of permanent revolution. Nothing will make them happy. I should tell you my joke here about the husband's straw, but I won't. I'll resist the temptation. So how do you argue with someone who purports to reject arguments? I'm almost finished, David. Okay. How can you converse reasonably with someone who purports to reject reason? The key word here is purport. The supposed rejection of rationality in argument is practically self-stultifying. You cannot do it. You can pretend to do it. You cannot actually do it. No one really does it. It's a rhetorical trick to insulate your position from criticism, to make sure that nothing penetrates the intellectual bubble. But nobody can actually live like this for long. Sooner or later, the force field slips. Okay, and that's your opportunity. Not to necessarily persuade somebody there and then, but to plant a little seed that will grow. There's a great piece there, How to Argue with Someone Who Won't Listen. It's the link is there for you, right? And so the person talks about how you know if somebody is in a state of cognitive dissonance, which is what, in fact, wokeism is. And there are seven markers, and I think it's very useful if you look at that. I won't go over that now. I'll just finish by saying, try to establish rapport with your interlocutor, whoever it is. Okay? If you come across as a human being, I know it's difficult for some of you. No, just joke. If you come across as a human being, okay, it's harder for them to cling to the idea that somehow you're intrinsically evil. If you seem reasonable, if you make a joke, if you laugh, okay, if you eat and drink. So all of these things dehumanize the conversation. It makes it difficult for them to persist to think of you in this particular way. And by the way, as in all discussions, there is no point in winning the argument if you lose the person. I'm a smart aleck. I've been a smart aleck all my life. I will die a smart aleck. My wife says, if you think he's bad now, you should have seen him when I knew him first when he was 20. My God, it was appalling. Okay, so, I mean, I love to win arguments, okay? And very often, what is the satisfaction? Person has retired in their shell. You haven't persuaded them. They're just persuaded that you're a jerk, right? It doesn't work, okay? What you're engaged in here is a kind of evangelism, in a sense. Evangelism of reason and persuasion and so on. So don't be an idiot. Don't be an ass. Okay. Don't be personally offensive. Give them time to talk. Okay. A few more things. Demonstrate no superiority if they indicate any sign of switching to your side. Go, ha, ha, ha. We've all been there. We've been there for years. Where have you been, stupid? Yeah, that's really going to make a convert, right? Yeah. Do not force people to live out their lives, the new values, or the values of the movement immediately. It's very hard for people to switch. The admission that you have to make, which is that you've been wrong about something fundamental that has been a core part of what you're doing, is humanly very, very difficult. So don't be an idiot. Help them along. You may well be in that situation yourself in regard to some of your beliefs at some stage. Okay, so to give them time to go there. Don't hold past inconsistencies against people. I do this all the time. Okay, don't do what I do. Okay, do what I say. Okay. And finally, okay, before I finish up for today, become aware of your own cognitive dissonances. Examine your own ways of thinking. Check out, in other words, those black spots, those dark areas of your own thinking where you haven't really investigated, where you're sensitive, and where you'd rather not that people have ask you questions about. Okay, make sure you know where you're coming from. Because if you're in the business of ops, any kind of conversion to somebody else, it's a good idea to be fully converted yourself. You've been very patient. Thank you all. It's great to see all you young people here. Wonderful.